Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 3 months ago, something we believed was unthinkable in the 21st century happened. Russia launched an unprovoked war against its neighbor, Ukraine. Vladimir Putin claimed it was to rid that nation of a Nazi threat. A total fabrication. In the time that has elapsed since we witnessed a fledgling democracy fighting valiantly to save itself, it was predicted that Ukraine would fall within days. It did not. Instead, Ukrainians prevented the Russians from taking over the nation. But the cost has been unimaginable as Russia attacked cities and civilians without mercy, committing war crimes in the process. Whole cities have been turned to rubble. Thousands have died and millions have fled the country. But this war also revealed serious weaknesses in the Russian military. They have incurred heavy casualties and serious loss of equipment, and the victory Putin was confident of securing has evaporated as he and his country and the oligarchs that surround him suffer from sanctions imposed by most of the world's nations. Those nations have been unwilling to enter the conflict directly, but they have shipped billions of dollars in military equipment to Ukraine, even as hundreds of millions of dollars have been sent to its refugees. But we are looking at this from far away. For our guest today, this is kind of personal. Roman Papadyuk's parents were born in Ukraine. He still has friends and family there. He also holds the distinction of being the first ambassador from the United States to Ukraine, following its becoming an independent nation after the fall of the Soviet Union. Ambassador Papadyuk is in town to speak at the World Affairs Council of Charlotte today, and he joins us for the hour. Thank you, Ambassador, for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike, and good morning to all your listeners. It's great to be with you this morning.
You served as our ambassador from 1992 to 1993 during the George H.W. Bush administration, and Ukraine had just become an independent country following the collapse the year previous to that, 1991, of the Soviet Union. I was looking back over Ukrainian history yesterday, just trying to update myself on all of this. Ukraine has been part of Russia, has not been part of Russia. Give us a little history lesson about the comings and goings of Ukraine on the world stage.
Sure, Mike. I think if you look at the history of Ukraine and the geography of Ukraine, Ukraine has been kind of between various empires. And that actually the term Ukraine, the name of the country Ukraine, means on the borderland. And that's a reference to the fact that it's been kind of squeezed between various empires on the east, mostly by Russia and Tsarist Russia before that, and Soviet Union, obviously, and on the west by, like, the going back centuries, the Lithuanian, Polish Commonwealth, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. In terms of the Ukrainian-Russian relationship, back in the 17th century, Russia was able to overtake the eastern part of Ukraine and administered it as part of its Tsarist Empire, under the name of Mala Rossiya. It was called Small Russia, Little Russia, during those days. So historically, there's been a very strong traditional link between eastern Ukraine and Tsarist/Soviet/Russian history, so to speak. Western Ukraine came under the control of the Russians only after World War II. And since that period, obviously, they held it until the independence of Ukraine in 1991. So there's been a long history of relations between the two peoples. It also stems a lot further back than the 17th century. Kievan Rus, which was the forerunner of the Ukrainian nation, took root in the city of Kiev, obviously. And Kievan Rus serves as the ancient roots for three Slavic groups, the Ukrainians, the Belarusians, and the Russians. It was also the center from which Christianity sprang that obviously has been taken up in Ukraine as well as in Russia and Belarus. So both in terms of religious background as well as ethnic roots, Kievan Rus serves as the font for the Ukrainians and the Russians. And what happened in the 13th century when Kievan Rus fell apart under the Mongol invasions, there was a branch of peoples that moved north to Novgorod and Muscovy, which became Moscow. And that's where the divides happened back then. Each group of peoples, Ukrainians and Russians, developing their separate track. The Russians, however, continued to view Ukraine as part of their overall sphere of influence and never really recognized Ukrainians as a separate peoples. And obviously, they administered a good portion of Ukraine, as I mentioned earlier, the eastern part for centuries. So it's come to the point where they've never recognized Ukrainians as a separate peoples. And your listeners and you might recall that back in July of last year, President Putin of Russia wrote an article in which he spoke about this, specifically stating that Ukraine was never a nation, that the Ukrainian people are not a separate people. They're part of the Russian peoples. So that's the view of what that Russia takes of the Ukrainian situation. Obviously, the Ukrainians don't view it the same way that the Russians do.
Yeah, this gets very, very complicated for the average person who hasn't paid much attention to this, because you wrote a paper for in 1996 for the Institute for National Strategic Studies, in which you point out that during its 700-year history, Ukraine was able to gain its freedom for approximately 10 years. That's not a lot of time. So I take it then that Russia, with some legitimacy, I don't know whether you would consider it that or not, they view this country as part of their country. Would that be accurate?
I don't think that would be very accurate. You have to make a distinction here. You're absolutely right in terms of the centuries, over the span of centuries, Ukraine never was able to maintain a long-term statehood. But you have to make a distinction between a nation and a state. Eastern Europe, to many in many degrees, if you look at the history of Eastern Europe, there are many nations, that is, ethnic groups, small and large, that have a common identity, a common history, and common goals. And you have to distinguish that from a state. Many of them have not been able to rule themselves because there were bigger powers around them. Ukraine falls into that category. It's been a nation for centuries in terms of identity, language, culture, cohesion, and viewpoints. It's seldom been able to maintain its statehood, going back to what I mentioned earlier in terms of the bigger powers that have surrounded it and have been able to dominate it, all the way from, you know, like I mentioned, the Polish Lithuanian Commonwealth, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as well as the Tsarist and then the Soviet empires, and now obviously Russia trying to overtake Ukraine at this stage. So that distinction has to be made. Now, if you make the argument about boundaries and everything, you say that Ukraine historically can be viewed as part of Russia. You could say that's accurate in terms of the history, but not of the feelings. But along that logic, Mike, almost any country in the world can claim someone else's territory. And it comes to the point that, there's got to be a stop to it, because almost any country that you pick can say, well, this territory is actually mine, I want it back, or this is my neighbor's, my neighbor should have the right to take it back. At some point, it's got to stop. I mean, Austria-Hungary can come, Austria can say that Western Ukraine is theirs. The Turks can say that Crimea is theirs. So this is a never-ending issue that can go on almost forever. If we start looking at what the past was, we have to look at what the present is right now, what the feeling of the individual groups of peoples is, and make sure we maintain peace within the boundaries that we have now.
In that same paper that I referred to, that you wrote for the Institute for National Strategic Studies, you say Ukraine faces three potential external security threats. Russia is one. Concern for being caught in the crosshairs of a NATO-Russian conflict is another. And the third is the various claims on areas on its border with Russia. Now, the first and third are in full evidence. Russia is quite obviously a threat, and there are these pockets of territory with that Ukraine says are theirs that Russia also claims. But there's this high rate of intermarriage among the people of Ukraine with Russian people in the two countries. Trade between the two countries has been strong. There are lots of other things going on there that you'd think would make for lasting friendships and peaceful relationships. Why wasn't that enough to maintain the status quo? I guess what I'm getting at is this purely a problem with Vladimir Putin?
I would say it's a problem with Vladimir Putin, but it goes a little bit bigger. I think it's a problem of the Russian ruling circles and mentality. I think overall Russia feels that in the wake of the end of the Cold War, Mike, there's a feeling that the West and the world has kind of ignored Russia. Russians saw themselves as being a major player in the world arena, and they feel they've been kind of shunted aside and not been given the type of respect that they think is warranted for them as a nuclear power. So I think what you're seeing is Putin probably playing out to a great extent the feelings of a lot of the Russian peoples as well as the Russian ruling circles in the sense that he wants to reestablish what he sees Russia's role in Europe, Russia's role on the international front. And this, of course, means taking over some of the what they view as their historical land and as a step toward that kind of reestablishment of their presence on the world arena.
You have a personal relationship with this country. Your parents were Ukrainians. They were interred in a forced labor camp in World War II, and you were born in a displaced persons camp in Austria following the end of that war. Did your parents ever return to Ukraine, or did they emigrate to the United States?
No, Mike, my parents never had the opportunity to go back to Ukraine. Once they left in 1950, I was born in 1950, and in 1950 we emigrated to the United States. We settled in Iowa Catholic Relief Services was the organization that sponsored us. So we settled in Iowa for about 5 months, and then in approximately, I think, May of 1951, we came to the East Coast and settled in New York City. My godfather was living there, so we went to New York because of that relationship. And I grew up in New York City, but my parents, unfortunately, never had the opportunity to go back. And unfortunately, from my personal point of view and my own feelings, they passed away before they saw the opportunity that I had of becoming the first U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
You received your U.S. citizenship at the age of 9, I read, and spent most of your adult life in America's Foreign Service. Is there a connection there, do you think, from your life as a naturalized citizen, your parents' experience during the war, their immigration to the U.S., and your desire and your interest in working with the diplomatic corps?
Oh, absolutely. You bring back a lot of fond memories, Mike, with that question, because we spent many times around the kitchen table, my parents and my two sisters, talking about Ukraine, talking about international affairs. So we were kind of raised with the notion of politics, both domestic as well as international, as a subject of discussion in family discussions. And that kind of spiked my interest in international affairs, obviously. So I studied political science as an undergraduate, went on to get a PhD in international affairs. And obviously that stimulated me to move on into the Foreign Service. So back in 1981, I joined the Foreign Service, and it was a very good career and a very rewarding career. And I would recommend that career for any young people now that are looking at what they would like to do in terms of their future careers.
So if I understand this correctly, your parents were born in Ukraine. Ukraine was then part of the Soviet Union under Stalin. The German army during World War II invaded that part of the country, took your parents and put them in forced labor. Why did they choose not to return once the war was over?
Now, that's a good question, but they were actually born, I would say, under my father was actually born under the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1915. That still existed. So it didn't become part of the Soviet Union. Western Ukraine didn't. They were both from Western Ukraine, by the way, which means, you know, they were held by Austria-Hungary, that territory,
right,
until after World War I.
I have to take a break. Ambassador, I have to take a break. We'll come back and get the rest of that answer in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Our guest today is Roman Papaduke, the first ambassador of the United States to Ukraine back in the early 90s. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council Charlotte today. And that last question that I ask you with insufficient time to allow you to answer properly is illustrative of the complicated nature of that area of the world, of Ukraine, because as you mentioned, your father was born when it was under the control of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I guess following World War II, it was under control of the Soviet Union. And is that why he chose not to go back following end of the war?
No, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, I guess, fell apart during the course of World War I. So everything was very fungible back in those days with the war and everything. Mike, to make a long story short, both my parents were taken as slave laborers by the Germans, by the Nazis, into what is now Austria. So they lived in Austria. They worked on adjoining farms, and that's how they met and married. And after the war, what happened is, to get to the bottom of your question, which is why they didn't return to the Soviet Union, was that my parents were in the Western sector. As you recall, after World War II, there were various sectors held by the Western countries as well as by the Soviet Union. We were in the Western sector, so we were basically protected from being going back, and they weren't expatriated or sent back. So being in the Western sector kind of helped them to stay where they were after the war in Austria.
So when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the first President Bush appointed you as this nation's first ambassador to Ukraine. And this is not a position you sought. According to CNN, it happened rather serendipitously due to a conversation you were having in Ukrainian with the first president of Ukraine as he was waiting to visit with President Bush in the aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union. Exactly what happened there? How did this all come to be?
Sure. President Leonid Kravchuk, who passed away a few days ago, God rest his soul, did a great job for his country in terms of its early days of independence. But he was visiting in September 1991. This is before we recognized Ukraine, and Ukraine had its independence referendum in December of that year. They had already declared independence in August. But he was at the White House, and he and I and Larry Eagleburger, the Deputy Secretary of State, were in the Roosevelt Room, which is just outside of the Oval Office, waiting for Kravchuk to go in and visit with the president. And Kravchuk and I were talking in Ukrainian about the Ukrainian-American community, how large it is, and, you know, its role, et cetera, kind of, you know, small talk. And Larry Eagleburger used a cane at times to walk, and he took that cane and tapped me on my legs playfully and said, "I know where I'm sending you." So that was an indication, I think, in his mind that as things were developing and Ukraine obviously had declared independence, was going to have the referendum, was going to be an independent country, that I was going to be headed to Ukraine.
So give us a little history lesson here, too, because I don't think when that happened that many Americans were paying much attention to Ukraine. The Soviet Union was collapsing. All these countries were disentangling themselves from that former empire. Did Ukraine set out to be a democratic nation at that time?
I would have to say yes. There are a number of things you have to recall. Ukraine, particularly Western Ukrainians, had a somewhat of a tradition of democratic rule. If you go back to the Cossack period, the Zaporozhian Cossacks had a kind of democratic system of electing their hetman or their leader. The other thing is, a lot of people don't realize Ukrainians produced one of the first constitutions in the world back in the 18th century that spoke about the separation of powers, et cetera. So Ukrainians do have a tradition of kind of democratic self-rule. And the fact that they had a referendum in December of 1991 to cement their independence indicates that things were thrown out to the populace. And in that referendum, over 90% of the Ukrainian people, including a majority of ethnic Russians, voted for independence for the simple reason that they felt that their future and the future of their children would be better off in an independent Ukraine than under Russian rule in a Russian state. Mm-hmm. In terms of the democracy, I mentioned President Kravchuk. He did a great job for his country because he was the first democratically elected president of Ukraine. And he lost re-election in 1994, but he stepped aside to President Kuchma, who defeated him in that race, and establish the tradition of, you know, peaceful transition of power. And that has actually continued. Ukrainians have had a number of presidential elections. Now, obviously, some of them have been marred and back in the Orange Revolution of, in the early years of this century, they had to do a revote because of international pressure in terms of some of the corruption that took place during one election. But the elections have taken place. The elections have led to peaceful transfers of power. And another thing I would mention is that Ukraine has a very active and engaged civic society that has been developed by Western NGOs as well as their own NGOs. So the Ukrainian people are very much cognizant of the role of politics, the need to be involved. And if anything, the Euromaidan demonstrations of 2013-2014 indicated how deeply engaged the Ukrainian people are and how they regard self-rule being a very important part of their social as well as political lives. So in short, Mike, yeah, I think the Ukrainians set out on the track of having a democratic state, and they are having very good political developments. Unfortunately, a lot of their successes is marred by the corruption which has been taking place in the country. But putting that aside, which you really can't, but you know, if you look at the politics of it, the politics have moved forward, the people are engaged, the elections do take place, and that's a great step forward to building a very viable and strong and stable democratic society and state.
You have said that Ukrainian foreign policy has been carefully constructed. They're trying to balance themselves carefully between East and West. You say that they are looking West, but smiling East. Expand on that. What's that mean?
Sure, absolutely. The Ukrainians definitely understood their role in terms of being between the East, Russia, and the West in terms of the various empires as well as individual large states in Western Europe. So they always felt they had to play a role not to upset Russia so that Russia wouldn't undertake any actions against them to undermine their stability. So this meant basically having good open relations with Russia, but at the same time not trying to make Russia have any kind of veto about their prospects and their desires to engage with the West. The Ukrainians really realized that any kind of economic development and well-being is going to be dependent on them becoming integrated with the Western cultures and Western economics. And so that's they would lean toward that direction, but at the same time, they didn't want to do anything that would upset the Russians to the point where they would engage in any kind of subterfuge against their society. So that was a very delicate balancing act. That all came apart basically in 2013-2014 when President Yanukovych, who was very pro-Moscow and leaned obviously toward Moscow, stopped the process of Ukraine moving toward integrating with the West when he pulled out of the discussions on the EU agreement and then turned his attention toward getting a loan from Russia as a means to help support Ukraine's economy. That ignited the popular uprising because the people were looking forward to being integrated with the West. And unfortunately, his action just brought everything to a boil, led to his fleeing the country, obviously then led to Russia getting engaged in Ukraine by seizing Crimea, annexing Crimea, and at the same time moving into eastern Ukraine to seize parts of the Donbass, namely parts of the Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast. And to that day, since that day, there's been a boiling kind of relationship between the two countries, which finally erupted with the Russian invasion in February of this year.
But why now? Why has Vladimir Putin decided that now is the time to do what he's doing?
That's a very good question, Mike. I would look at it this way. I think it was a confluence of forces. I think basically, obviously, the only country that would be able to sustain Ukraine in any kind of conflict was the United States. And I think Vladimir Putin, being the KGB operative that he was in the past, took a good look at the world. And I think he's noticed a sense, he sensed, erroneously in my view, a feeling of weakness on the part of the United States, that the United States is divided over all kinds of cultural and social and political issues. Politics seems to be very divisive in the United States. He saw that as a sign of weakness. He doesn't understand our society. We do have an open society. We do talk about various issues, and we do have conflicts over issues. And I'm talking about, social and political issues, conflicts in the sense that we have different points of view. That actually turns out to be a strength in our country because we talk things out and try to work things out. He saw this as a sign of weakness to a certain extent, I believe, so he misread the situation. But then again, you have to realize that there was really no response by our government in the 2008 attack on Georgia. There was really no response when Putin moved into Crimea and Donbass, as I mentioned earlier, in 2014. So he saw that this might be a possibility that he could take advantage of his perceived weakness of the United States and the United States' unwillingness to move forcefully in past incidents involving Russia and its neighbors. The other thing you have to realize, during the past few years, we had a tendency, particularly under the previous administration, the Trump administration, the feeling that the United States was withdrawing from the world. We had pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership economic discussions. We were critical of our allies under the administration. So there was a feeling that the United States was giving up its leadership role in the world. And then top it off, in February, early February, you had the Beijing Olympic Games, where Putin and Xi Jinping of China got together and signed their partnership agreement. So I think that confluence of forces, perceived weakness from Putin's view of the United States, the track record that we had in terms of how we were acting on individual Russian activities over the years, and how the United States was dealing with its allies. And then I think Putin felt emboldened by having that relationship with China. And I think all of that confluence of forces led him to move forward. I don't think it was an accident, that to a certain extent he started building up his forces around Ukraine in March of last year, right after President Biden was basically inaugurated, because it was under Presidents Obama and Biden that Putin was able to move into Donbass and Crimea. So I think, I'm not faulting any one single administration, whether it's Democratic. I think the Obama administration had some faults in its relationship to Ukraine. And obviously the Trump administration had its faults in terms of the signals that might have gone out to Russia in terms of how we were dealing with our allies. So I think a confluence of forces and mistakes, both by Democratic and Republican administrations, led to what we have now is the invasion of Ukraine.
Aside from the political aspect of this, his timing in terms of what he thought the United States would be involved in this at all, and aside from the fact that this is kind of a vanity project on the part of Vladimir Putin, who wants to regain face and power and control and restore Russia to what he perceives to be its rightful place in the hierarchy of nations, is there a strategic importance to Russia to this? Aside from the ports of Mariupol and Odessa, Ukraine is known as the breadbasket of Europe. It supplies food for over a half a billion people or more. And together with Russia, they supply a quarter of the world's wheat and half of its sunflower products, which are very important in parts of the world. Is that part of this?
I would say it's part of it, but I think, and I'll get to it, Mike, but I think you have to look at it in a greater scope here. I think one of the major threats that Putin sees from Ukraine is actually democracy. Let's go back to what we spoke about earlier. As Ukraine develops as a viable democracy, it turns increasingly to the West, and that creates two problems for Putin. Number one, as an authoritarian leader and as an authoritarian state, any movement on the part of Ukraine to become and strengthen its democracy, I think the Russian leadership fears would serve as a symbol to Russia itself. You have to understand Russia has a growing democratic movement and a growing reform movement, all of which is pushing to change Russia's traditional authoritarian culture and make it more of an open society, more of a democratic society. So any success on the part of Ukraine in that avenue would, I think, the Russians leadership feels would undermine their standing within an authoritarian structure. And mind you, you have to realize that the Russians, as I mentioned at the outset of our conversation, Mike, view the Ukrainians as really part of their peoples. That they, and you could imagine the Russians saying, well, you know, if you view them as part of our peoples, they're becoming democratic and all, why can't we have democracy? So that can't be allowed to happen. So there's a need to try to quash Ukraine to as a result of that. And the other thing is, I spoke about Ukraine moving toward the West. As Ukraine moves toward the West and starts growing economically, that's another symbol that the Russian people will see, that the Ukrainians have freedom of movement, freedom of trade, freedom of cultural development, and it's something that's not really possible for them under an authoritarian regime. So those ingredients are very, very important. In terms of what you mentioned about the agricultural strength of Ukraine, and then if you add Russia to it, the strength of the both of them, you're absolutely right. There is a great strength in Ukraine in terms of its agriculture. Two-thirds of its territory is Chernozem, the black earth, which is very productive, some of the most productive soil in the world. Ukraine is a very major producer of barley, wheat, corn, sunflower, and a great exporter of those products. For Ukraine to export those products, it relies on its ports. You mentioned, I think, Mariupol, for example. Mariupol's major export facility and now has been devastated by the Russian attacks. So both on the Sea of Azov and on the Black Sea coast, Ukraine has export facilities for moving the grain into the international markets. If Russia is able to control the flow of those exports, it controls much of Ukraine's economic development. It could strangle Ukraine economically. And by all means, I think Russia's objective is not only to grab eastern Ukraine, but to try to swing all the way up to Crimea for a land bridge between the Donbas and Crimea, and maybe swing toward Odessa. You've noticed over the past few days that they've been heavily bombing Odessa. And from there, they could move easily into Moldova. If they get that whole sea coast, both the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov, they strangle Ukraine. Ukraine would have no access to the waters and no access to be able to ship its grain out of the country. As a matter of fact, right now, Ukraine is shipping some of its grain via rail to Romania.
Let me stop you there because I have to take a break, Ambassador Papadiouk. I have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that and then get your assessment of our approach to all of this in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Roman Papadiouk, the first ambassador from the United States to Ukraine back in the 1990s, 1992, 1993. He's in town today to speak at the World Affairs Council luncheon at noon today at the Hilton Uptown. There are tickets still available for that at the moment. I'm going to enter the lightning round of questions here, Mr. Ambassador, because I have a ton of questions and not a lot of time left. But the West has taken, although a fairly aggressive approach, it's also been pretty cautious. We're not committing ground troops. We've kind of walked a tight wire in terms of supplying them with military equipment, although it's pouring in. Well, certain things are not getting in, like aircraft and things like that. But given the fact that there is this importance agriculturally of supplying a good part of the world with products, which the flow of which has now pretty much stopped, how long can we afford to remain cautious? We're talking about people going hungry in parts of the world because they're not getting the grain that comes out of Ukraine. How long can we afford this approach?
Well, Mike, you make a very legitimate point. I don't have a time frame I can offer to you, but I do have to rephrase a few things. Number one, I think the combination of Russia and Ukraine produces something like half of the wheat that the World Food Program provides to a lot of people around the world. I know countries like Egypt, Lebanon, Pakistan are becoming impacted by this and will have a greater impact as this grain is being withheld. I think at this stage of the game, Mike, what's important is for the West to continue providing the type of military equipment that the Ukrainians have requested. The Ukrainians have indicated that they do not want boots on the ground from the West. They are willing to undertake the fight by themselves, and they've proven themselves very capable and very well motivated. All they wanted was the equipment. If they have the equipment, I feel confident they can stave off the Russian onslaught. By doing so, they'll be able to reopen the ports, or at least be able to reopen their ability to send grain out to the outside world. As I mentioned before the break, they are already shipping grain to Romania via train. So there are other means by which they could get the grain out. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and by using trains, they won't be able to ship as much as you can by boat and all. But the main thing right now is for the West to provide the means for the Ukrainians to stave off the Russian attack and push it back. Once that happens, then the economy would have a greater chance of opening up, and the flow of grain, I think, would be resumed. Obviously, not to the extent that it's been going on before the war. You have to keep in mind that even as the Ukrainians continue to push the Russians back, the grain has been impacted to a great extent, not only by the conflict, but also by what the Russians themselves have been doing. There have been reports of the Russians taking grain and shipping it to Russia. There have been reports of the Russians taking the farm equipment and shipping it to Russia. If you take the farm equipment, it's going to be difficult to, obviously, in the areas where it's been removed, to start planting and harvesting. So there are big problems in Ukraine besides just the actual shipment methods of the grain.
For someone who has a diplomatic background, you had a rather blunt assessment of how the United States has responded to all this. You said, "I think we handled it wrong from the get-go." But I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that by the get-go, you mean not the beginning of this war, but the fall of the Soviet Union. Is that accurate?
I think, yeah, I would say we had it kind of wrong from the beginning of the Cold War. I mean, the end of the Cold War, as well as now. What I mean by that, Mike, is in the early stages post-Cold War, there was a kind of a division of view on how to approach the former Soviet space. Just briefly, one point of view held that Russia will develop as a democracy and as a capitalist economy, and we needed to support Russia in these efforts in any way, means, shape possible. Another point of view basically said that's accurate. We do need to support Russia, and we need to work with Russia because Russia is an important power. But at the same time, we need to put some emphasis on the individual republics that became independent in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union, namely countries like, you know, Ukraine, Kazakhstan. We had to put more effort into supporting them economically, militarily, as well as diplomatically. And the rationale behind that was that the Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire fell apart, Russia was still a big major power and still an empire with the vast holdings of territory as well as ethnic groups throughout its territory. And there was no guarantee Russia would become a changed country overnight and become a democracy and might revert back to its old roots of empire building. And so we had to guarantee against that. And unfortunately, history has shown that Russia never, while it started moving in the direction of reform under Gorbachev and Yeltsin, never really took hold as Putin grabbed power and Russia reverted to its traditional authoritarian means. That's one problem I think we encountered, and unfortunately we didn't foresee that problem. We just didn't foresee that Russia would swing back to its old empire.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you have said that we, through Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, failed to recognize the threat that Russia posed to its neighbors. These presidents don't work in isolation. They're advised by others in the government, from the State Department to the Department of Defense to the CIA. They all missed the threat of that. How?
Well, that's a very good question. There were a lot of other assumptions that were based on this. The assumption, as I mentioned, is that if you work with Russia, you might be able to influence its development. And that's a very legitimate argument. You can make that argument. We made the same argument with the Chinese, as you recall, that if we open the doors to China in terms of trade, allow them to join the World Trade Organization, the Chinese would develop along the lines of the Western model. And unfortunately, that hasn't happened for the Chinese as well. So that's a legitimate argument to make in terms of of an approach. Keep the door open, work with the country, and the country can change and fit into the mold of becoming a constructive member of the international community. The other thing you have to realize on terms of Russia, we do have a working relationship with Russia, whether it was in space, you know, terrorism. So there was a working relationship that was ongoing there, and that relationship, no one really wanted to disturb that relationship. And, of course, there was a great energy needs for Europe in particular, and that relationship had to be maintained both by Europe and the United States to keep those energy flows going. So while we missed it, there were basic assumptions, you know, that I'm not going to be critical of people. There were basic assumptions from which I think a lot of these analysts were operating on. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way.
Well, you actually have been critical of people, and I think that's interesting. Nothing wrong with that, I suppose. You have blamed the current president because he and his administration released so much accurate intelligence about Putin's intention prior to the war. Other experts have praised Biden for taking this strikingly different approach because it showed Putin for the liar that he's turned out to be, and it demonstrated to Putin just how little he has been able to hide from us. You believe that was a mistake. Why?
I believe that was a mistake. When I say I'm not being critical, I'm not being critical of the assumptions people had as analysts of, of the unfolding of Russia. Individual administrations, I would be critical of in terms of actions, particularly of the Biden administration. I think it's very telling, and it'll be very interesting to see how historians judge this lead up to the war, because for a month or so before the war broke out, the administration was speaking about knowing all the moves that the Russians were about to take, almost to the date and time that the Russian attack would take place. Well, the interesting part about all this is, if you knew all this was going to take place, why didn't you give the Ukrainians all the arms they needed at that time? That might have sent a very strong signal to Putin that, hey, if I do attack, these guys are going to be armed to the teeth, and it might be a little bit more bloody, and the cost-benefit analysis would go up considerably for Putin. So I would fault the administration for, while they may be accurately had the intelligence right, they didn't parallel the intelligence with their actions. And I think the actions would have been very, very should have been very forthcoming in terms of giving Ukraine the type of weapons they needed. They might have blunted might have prevented the attack. That we don't know.
But on the other hand, they might have exacerbated the situation that may not have happened. I mean, they may have amped up the tensions and caused an attack that may not have occurred in the absence of our supplying weapons. Is that not a valid school of thought?
That is a valid point of view. I don't agree with that point of view, however. Okay. I think history has shown that any time you show weakness in the face of someone trying to push, you know, the envelope to the edge of the table, so to speak, or try to push their actions, that encourages that person to become even more aggressive in their activities. And that's where I fault the administrations also.
Let's talk about timidity, because we are the most powerful military nation in the world. We spend 37% more on defense than any other nation. And yet we can only send military aid and ammunition and equipment to this conflict. We're not going to send planes, because the transfer of planes might be viewed as our direct participation in this conflict. Is this all over our concern that Putin might do something crazy, like using nuclear weapons, or are we just being far too timid in this situation?
I don't want to use the word timid. I think I would phrase it this way, Mike. I think we're letting Putin set the parameters and the narrative, and that's unfortunate. What we are doing is reacting to everything that Putin's been doing.
But what's the alternative? What's the alternative to that? If you were in charge, what would you have done?
Yeah, I would have done two things. Number one, I would have given equipment to Ukraine to be able to carry out the conflict in a proper way. That would have incurred more cost to Putin in the early stages. In other words, I would have given as much equipment to the Ukrainians as possible. The other thing I would have done is I would have changed the narrative a little bit, Mike. I would have upped the ante, so to speak, for the Russians. If the Russians took an action X, I would have done an X plus Y, just to show them that we're not going to be intimidated, and to put the ball in their court to react. The good example is what you talked about, is the fixed-wing aircraft, the MiG-29s. I would have provided those to the Ukrainians. Remember, the Poles wanted to do that, and we kind of backed out at the last minute when the Poles asked us to deliver those. that sends a signal of weakness, I think, to Putin. If we had agreed to that, it would have been up to Putin to react. How would he have reacted at that stage? That would have put the onus on him to escalate or de-escalate or to keep the conflict at the level it was at that time. That's what I fought the administration on, that we were not willing to face Putin face on and to up the ante a little on him to have him react to the activities that the West was undertaking.
Yeah, and you've also said that there needs to be a red line for the West. What should that red line be, and what should our response be if Russia crosses that red line?
All right. Well, there were a number of red lines that took place. The first red line was the actual invasion. I think we should have been a lot stronger in terms of the two things. Number one, we shouldn't have just dribbled out the sanctions piecemeal. Our sanctions have been piecemeal over the last, 3 months. It seems we're coming up with new sanctions every other week or so. When you do sanctions, you should do it all at once, hit them and hit them hard. The other thing is we should have given out the military equipment to Ukraine as quickly as possible. I think I would have undertaken those efforts. So yeah. We have to be very careful in terms of our strategy and how we approach this. We needed to do things quickly, and we had to do them straight on right away.
I only have a couple minutes left, and we're watching these negotiations, on and off negotiations between Ukraine and Russia with diplomats in a room. And I want you to put us in that room. When you have both sides who are not going to back down, what's the point? What actually happens in those negotiations?
Well, actually, nothing really happens. Mike, if you look at the situation right now.
So why have them? Why have the meeting?
Well, you have to have them for a certain reason. There are two types. The negotiations can be broken down into two levels right here, Mike. One is the actual settlement of the conflict, which I think is not going to be possible because neither side is going to be willing to give ground on the one important thing to each side, and that's namely real estate. Putin's going to want to hold on to eastern Ukraine. You remember right before the conflict, he announced his recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk as independent republics. So he's not going to give ground on that. And the Ukrainians obviously are not going to want to give up territory. That, I think, is going to be a stalemate. So you're looking at a frozen conflict probably over time there. The other part of negotiations and diplomacy can involve some of the results of it. For example, you can negotiate a ceasefire. You can negotiate free corridors for refugees to be able to get out. You can negotiate for humanitarian relief to be delivered. So there are a variety of things that you can negotiate, and it's very worthwhile to come to the negotiation table to talk these things out. But I think in terms of a definitive settlement of the war through diplomacy, it's going to be very, very difficult. I think both sides are going to be very strong and adamant in their demands. Yeah. And that's only going to lead to a stalemate, I think, which is in Russia's favor because they'll wind up holding onto territory unless Ukraine can really.
Which leads me to a final question in the 30 seconds we have left. If this conflict does come to an end, and the end of it is Russia keeping some of those eastern areas of Ukraine, will this war really continue? Will it become a guerrilla war on the part of Ukraine to try to regain those pieces of territory?
It depends on how much territory the Russians take and how much of a strength the Ukrainians have in the areas that are overtaken. You have to realize places like Mariupol have been wiped out. Right. There's hardly anyone left there. Refugees have been taken out. People have fled the cities, etc. I think what you look at is kind of a Minsk process where there'll be a stalemate over time, and there'll be grounds for Russia to maybe try this kind of gambit again in a few years. And that's the unfortunate thing of it.
And with that, we have to leave it. Roman Papadyuk, our guest, the first ambassador of the United States to Ukraine back in 1992. Thank you very much for the history lesson, the education, and for the hour. Appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.